did presentation. Okay, so that means I need to switch gears here then. Okay, so anyway, we do have a schedule. And before we begin, I would like to ask one of our elders. I noticed that Elder Elmer Ghostkeeper is here. I'm not sure if Mary Collins is here as well, because she did confirm. So I'm going to go ahead and ask maybe our Elder Elmer Ghostkeeper to share a prayer with us so that we can begin our session in a good way. Miigwech.
Good morning, everybody. It's always an honor to say an opening prayer, to ask Creator to start us off in a good way, to speak words of wisdom from the heart rather than from the brain. And later, I'd like to share just a little bit, if there's time, with the others. I was sent a very good book for my birthday present, and it's I think it's hot off the press, and some of you might have already read it, but I'd like to read a quote from it. So with that, I'll say the prayer in my first language. Sagan Hiawaya, Bushlan Cree. Mami Nuhtawi Mau, Iguakigani no. Asamina.
Kimigwech, for that beautiful prayer, Elmer. I just want to turn it over to our executive director now, Pamela McCoy-Jones, if she can share the land acknowledgement and maybe give some welcoming remarks.
Thank you, Violet. Thank you, Elmer, for the prayer this afternoon, and for all of you for logging on. I see some U of A staff, I see some students, I see some community members, and respected elders and advisors. So I guess I'll just start with the acknowledging all of you, acknowledging that we are on Treaty 6 land here in Edmonton, Alberta, and the amazing work that's being done within language revitalization across the nation. You know, we are situated at the U of A, University of Alberta, but that recognition of all the language champions who have really set the stage for us to build on the work that's being done here and for our future generations, for our children and our children's children. So the Supporting Indigenous Language Revitalization Initiative at the University of Alberta is really about building capacity and supporting the language revitalization work that's going on in community and the work that's been going on at the University of Alberta. So we're building on that, and we're finding different ways to network. So this language series is really an opportunity to hear from people like Molly Chisake and from Elder Elmer Ghostkeeper about their perspectives and their worldviews on language revitalization and what that means, and how we can, you know, learn from them and build this network and this community of language learners, language teachers, language activists. So Miigwech, thank you for logging on, and thank you for our presenters today.
Okay, Miigwech, Pamela, I just want to welcome our other staff as well. I'm not sure which staff we have attending our session today, but welcome to each and every one of you. And I also want to acknowledge our project, Siller Project Assistant, Corinne Rydell. She's kind of the background worker of getting all the details together so that we can have these sessions available to you. I also would like to introduce myself. Violet Okimau Nadijanikas, Omemu Zeeping Nitonji. My name is Violet Okimau. I'm originally from Barons River First Nation in Manitoba. I'm currently the curriculum director for the Siller Project. So Corinne and I get to organize these sessions, the Indigenous Language Sharing Series, as well as other student sessions. We also organize other professional development opportunities for the students. I always call them students. They're the, I guess, the pre-service teachers that are currently enrolled in the Faculty of Education here at the University of Alberta. So I guess that's basically all I'll say for now. I'm really honored to be able to introduce our guest today. Her name is Molly Chiseke, and I just want to mention that I just picked up Molly about 30 minutes ago from her place. So she told me quite a few stories along the way. So I'm sure that you will hear some of those stories as we proceed with her sharing. Before Molly begins sharing, I just wanted to read out her bio. This is the bio that was included in some of the correspondence that was sent to us. So I'm going to read it. It's in first person. So this is Molly talking. So I'm going to read her bio. She says here, I am a fluent Dene Thaw language speaker. My grandparents are from Treaty 8 First Nations of Alberta. I believe we must hold onto our cultural values through shared teachings. And my educational background comes from a lived experience and from establishing safe places for our families and to promote healthy, cultural-focused, language-based teachings. I am a graduate from the Grant McEwen Community College, which allowed the opportunity to have met many powerful Indigenous leaders and mentors. I have learned that before we speak on matters, first, we must learn to listen, to let others speak, and listen to the still and sit with the youth whom we trust will find their own voices and path in living today. Dene Thaw language has its shared knowing and values that are living ways and voices enriched with my own kinship. Today, our shared knowledge of how our elders' voices echo into our hills today. So I'd like everybody to welcome Molly. I do have a couple of questions, some general questions that I'm going to be asking Molly throughout the session. So it's about 1:11 right now. So hopefully I will be asking her to respond to some of the questions that I'm going to be asking till about 1:30, 1:35. And then we can also open it up to whomever would like to ask any questions. If you have any questions for Molly, if we can, you know, leave those till the latter part of the interview. And then if you have any particular questions that you would like to document, you can just include them in the chat, and Corinne Rydell will be reading those questions out so that Molly is able to answer any of the questions that you have. So Molly, I do have four general questions for you. And the first question is actually getting to know you better. I know I've gotten to know you a little bit, you know, throughout the months that I've been here at University of Alberta. But maybe for others that have not met you before, the first question I'm going to ask you is if you can tell us about who you are. Tell us about yourself, maybe the family that you're from, the community, as well as maybe some of your experiences, you know, as a young child, and also going maybe whatever schooling you entered during your younger years. And in between, I may be asking you questions before I move on to the second one. Is that okay?
That's really good. Okay. I am happy to be sharing some of what and who I am about as an important part of language speakers. We always want to share who we are, where we come from, and the important part is who you are related to in community. And I was born into a family of Dene Da First Nation. I was introduced to two dialects. As a child, I spoke one dialect, which was my father's dialect, and the other language dialect was my mother's. And when I went to my grandparents, I spoke again two different dialects, one to my grandfather and to my grandmother. And when we went down the road to my great uncles, we spoke a different dialect. And I never realized that these were just some of the ways that we learn in talking and in formulating our language-based knowledge and skill at being able to learn through the grandparent and parent teachings of how we moved in the early years, how in the summertime we lived outside for the entire summer. And we lived in the log houses during the wintertime, and we all helped to procure how the building was constructed. We all took part in tearing it down and repairing it. And we all watched and we were all participants, whether we were looking after the little ones and helping packing some of the siblings who were smaller on our backs during the times that there was moose hide, making blankets outside being made in the springtime. We were always busy. So likewise, we never really took the time to reflect on what we were learning, but we were always observed by the elders around us, and the older generation took it up upon themselves that if we were in a certain area, like in the fishing down the lake or ice fishing, there was always a grandmother sitting there, and she would make holes for two or three other children. And that was how we did things. And the other thing is we knew exactly what the fish names were, each one that we caught. And we knew the different sizes of beaver and what their names were as children, because our families were built on going to the trap line. Our fathers went off in the fall and in the wintertime and in the springtime. So seasonally, we all had expectations put on us to be helping. And through the helping, we had a lot of non-interference teachings and learning pedagogies that were built on the value system of the elderly and the older family kinship. When I talk about myself you notice that I don't say I am this person and this is all the things that are important to me. Instead, I say I belong to this group. And as a grandparent, as a mother, as a great-grandparent, I have a responsibility to not tell anybody what to do, but to kind of be there to support and to help the younger generation to make decisions for themselves. And that is a very important practice in our culture to pass on some of those teachings. And when we do, like for me, I look at how our language in the past to the present has been broken up and how the layers of unraveling our history and the core of our meaningful values that connect us to the land has been broken down by the removal, by the policy, by the church, by the government, by the institution that continues to fail us in education, and how that education systemically continues to eradicate the cultural norms that we used to have. Like, for example, when we were small, I don't know if other people in the community had this, but my grandfather would get up in the morning if he was home, and my cousin and I would stay sleeping at my grandparents', and my grandfather would get up and start the fire, and then he would be drumming as the tea and whatever else was cooking. And for us, we thought that was what every other household was exposed to, and that they were doing the similar things. And the other part to it is when we were very small, I was, along with my older brother, we were living with our grandparents. And we have a large family, and so we spent a lot of our time with our grandparents. So there were teachings that were passed on to us by the grandparents. And the other elders that lived in that area. And when you have those kinds of practices that are not spoken about, but it's just that when my grandmother, when they were going to go camping on the land, one of the other relatives, he would come to my grandmother's, and he would talk to her, and she would decide where we were going to be camping. And so that man would go from house to house and say, this is where we're going to move to. And it was not something that was written, or it's just something that my grandmother was in a position to be making those decisions, those kinds of decisions. So when you have family, they are pretty much built on those kinds of foundations, where you have the safety of the group, and where we're going to move to, where there's water, where they're going, what were they going to be hunting for. And so at the same point, you have to go back on the land to pick your medicines. And there are lots of teachings that happens and occurs during those camps. And so everybody is kept busy for the entire time that we are moving on the land. And the, like us, we were children, but we learned how to ride horses. Sometimes we were expected to ride horses. And so we had to learn how to do extra things like that. And that took a lot of skill. And you can't jeopardize the whole camp by being disrespectful of the animals or anything that you're supposed to be not doing. So those are some of the teachings that we grew up with as children. And when we went to the Indian residential school, a lot of those teachings were, they didn't have any meaning anymore, because we were supposed to line up, we were supposed to be ordered around, and all of a sudden we were silenced and we were beaten up by the systemic institution. And so that kind of went against the grain of the value system of the culture. And when we are going through this revitalization process, I say process because I remember one of my teachers at the Nietzsche Institute, where I took training, had told me that our elders have always said that we don't suddenly just stop learning, or we don't suddenly, my grandfather used to say, you have a whole lifetime, and during your lifetime, you will learn many things. And when you are going through, when you are packing up what you're going to take out for the day, where are you going to be through your day? You have to be able to pack your own backpack, and you have to know what you're going to bring for the day and what you will need, and take only what you need and what you will use, and don't take things that you won't use because it's just going to be holding you down because of the weight. And so we kind of learned little things like that. And when we're at the Indian residential school, there was only one language. And there was a lot of influx of new words that were coming up. And my father's language wasn't spoken so much there. And so we switched over to the language that was spoken there. And it's funny because we kind of lost the words for the trees, for the land, the formation of the land, the types of seasons, that the snow, how many names for snow, how many names for, like I said, if you are going to help your father to skin a beaver, you have to know what the beaver's name is. And in our language, we don't use the term of like the English term. So it was really confusing to do the translating from our Dinidal language to the English. And some of the English words we were learning, we would think in our language and we would laugh because it didn't make sense to us, like running shoes. the shoes doesn't run. And when we were in grade one, we would laugh and laugh because our teacher would say, I laugh my head off. And we just laugh at them because you can't laugh your head off. And so it was really interesting for us to learn those kinds of language back and forth. And ultimately, we began to translate for some of our elders. And I know, like, for my children, the oldest of my children was very fortunate to be in an environment where there was lots of language speakers and grew up in a only Deneda speaking environment. And I believe that being a language activist, I have an obligation, and I do have to protect those cultural values that are passed down from our languages. Like when you have like a little boy in the house, you don't just walk over their clothes and you don't leave them on the floor. And you have to hang up your hat and you can't throw your hat on the floor. It's just those kinds of things that we learned. And it has a lot to do with the respecting of the family members and knowing that if you're gonna take something, you have to put something back. And if you borrow something, you have to tell them that you borrowed something, but you also have to give back. And so it's just part of the learning those kinds of values that I learned in the language-based teachings. And I hope that this answers some of your questions.
Violet, you have to unmute.
I had too many people yelling at me. Okay, thank you for the reminders. Okay, so thank you, Molly, for sharing your childhood experiences, as well as some of the challenges that you've experienced at residential school. I know that many of those life experiences that you've had as a young child, I think, are very similar to life experiences that many Indigenous families have experienced as well. And in listening to what you've shared so far, I'm thinking about, all of those, Indigenous practices and also teachings and values that I hear you sharing with us today. And we know that, our generation right now, we have a very different experience compared to what our children or grandchildren are experiencing today. And I'm thinking about, the experiences that most of us have had in terms of growing up in our communities and just speaking the language, our own language, our ancestral language. And then eventually when we were expected to go to school, all of a sudden, our language was not important. And I heard you say that as well. There was a really big change there. The residential school, brought out a lot of, negative experiences for everybody. And I didn't go to residential school, but I went to day school. So a lot of those experiences were very similar. like we were raised, you know, in our community with our parents, with our grandparents. There were many teachings, many experiences that were taught to us. And then all of a sudden, when we entered that day school experience as well, our language, we weren't allowed to speak our language. And that's what you have mentioned as well. The other question that I wanted to ask you, and maybe if you can just add to what you've shared so far, if you want to share any other stories based on maybe some of the experiences that you've had as a language revitalization supporter, or I noticed you used the word activist earlier. So can you maybe share a little bit more experiences in terms of your current role within Edmonton here? Because I know that we are now living in the city, right? So what are some of your other roles and responsibilities? Oh, you got to unmute as well.
As an Indigenous language activist, one of the things that happened is I remember learning a word on demographical changes and how we learn to define words in discussion and in conversation about how we come to this place as possibly being teachable. And for me, it's really an important part of growing older and possibly maybe wanting to help promote the practices of our culture and our ways of living by, like, for instance, when I decided to go back to school, I kind of wanted to be a social worker. And then I realized that the social worker that, and I started my classes and I instantly was on the honors list. And I decided I didn't want to be a social worker because of the way that the broken up of the kinship ties. Like, you have to live under one roof, in separate, like, and you can't be helping and guiding, and sometimes that really makes gives that message that there's a learned helplessness and hopelessness in family kinship. And I decided that I'm going to go into something else. So when I took communications, I wanted to learn to become a very good communicator. And I decided I'm going to learn to become a, I would help to translate and to transcribe and to promote and to protect our culture and our values and the meaning and the purpose of how to live a simple life. And that when you have a family who are drummers, who are song keepers, who have ceremony, who are leaders, who have leadership, who are hunters, gatherers, who go fishing on the land, who have relied on those practices and like for me, I helped my mom with moose hide tanning. And today, to me, the revitalization is a process of living and unraveling the things that were outlawed to us and forbidden to us at one time. And to go back, it's not going backwards to revisit those things that were lost. It's to go and be very, like for me, I got really good and angry, and I said, I am going to demand that right to speak my language. Like right now, what am I going to say today is important to me, because I am important for the things that I have to share. And there are too many elders who are passing away with their stories and their values in our communities. And that puts us in a disposition of loss and more grief. And that has a dire consequence on the intergenerational trauma from the colonial, systemic, institutionalized racist policies that continues to divide us today. I used to really listen when we went to our gathering circles when I was a kid, because that one day I was just rolling around with my cousin in the hay, in that grass, in at a tea dance circle, and we were kicking each other and giggling, and that one lady, my great auntie, she took a stick and she just whacked us on the leg, and she said, that elder is talking to you. You better sit down and listen. And I must have been about maybe 8 or 9, and I remember sitting up straight. And I started to listen, because the elder was talking about a time will come when people will go into, they would have, they like, what did they say? They said that a time will come when you will be afraid to open the door to somebody who might be your relationship, your relatives, and you will be afraid of them. And that elder was saying stuff like that. And he said, there will also be a time when you will take your pail and go down the river and take a pail of water, but you will be afraid to drink of it, even though it's very clear and clean. And like he was saying all this, and he was talking about those kinds of things. To me, like the elder was saying, in gathering, we are no longer divided. And I heard those kinds of stories, and those stayed with me. And those are some of the beliefs that really influenced my choice in some of the things that I decided to do, because he said that they would, if you take a drink of that moonshine or alcohol, once the highway comes in, the white men that will come will take everything from under us, and they will give you this drink, and if you look inside of it and take of it, it will cloud your mind, and you will no longer know who you are or where you come from. and your children will be lost, and they will not know how to talk back to you. So when my oldest daughter came to Sildi, she said, take this course. And I said, no, I don't have to. I speak my language. It's just more ways for them to take away from us. And she really pushed me, and now I am here. And she is back home. And I have a very huge commitment. Every place where I am part of the, my role is to help promote healing from the ravages of our past and the horrific damage of the atrocities from the intergenerational trauma, and that we must help each other to understand that we are not alone, and that we have to reach out and we have to help to attend those gatherings. And I know in Edmonton, there will be a place called the Sacred Land. It's called Kitchiaski in Cree. It is going to be opening in the springtime. There are things like that that are happening, and it's very important part of the process to take back our talk.
Okay, thank you for all of the new information that you've shared with us, Molly. I do have like a couple more questions that I wanted to ask you, and then we're going to open it up to the rest of the participants. But before we do that, I know that Dr. Elmer Ghostkeeper also wanted, a bit of time when you're done the questions. Okay, so I just have two more questions that I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
One of the many challenges that we have with our children now, or with our grandchildren, is that they're learning our ancestral languages in the schools. Now, that presents, I guess, many challenges. What advice would you give language instructors or language teachers out there so that the language is passed on to this generation and generations to come?
I think how we learned our languages is through our early learning is in groups. And when we are camping in groups, everybody talked in Dene. There's not nobody who talk English. There wasn't one language spoken in English. And when we went home for the summer from the residential school, all we did was camp for the entire summer. And during the whole time, we spoke only in our language. And when you go on the land and you bring the children and you speak only in Dene, they start getting mad and they start telling you have to tell me what you're saying. And you just tell them you have to pay attention and try to learn. And I know in back home in certain households, there's only Dene speakers. There's no English. And one of the big language removal that stepped on our community like this big step is the child welfare, the social workers taking children away. And that really cuts off the language. and it destroys utterly the cultivating the value systems. And it's very damaging and it's very harmful to families and for language speakers. And because then there's a big division between the young people and the elderly, and you can't tell them nothing. The young people just think they can talk back and they have come up with this real attitude. And so you just be quiet. And that's one of the things that was told to me by one of the elders. And there's a big division caused by this. And as a positive way and means to promote and to protect and to keep practicing our values is to instill those teachings. Like if you do beadwork, do the beadwork when you are not drinking or when you are not smoking or not smoking pot, or you have cultural values where, like when I was growing up, they said that when you start having your menstruation, you are separated from whatever everybody else is doing, and you're left with your grandmother and your aunties, and they teach you that you have to start sewing, and they teach you what colors are you going to be picking, and you have to sew, and you have to do cooking, and you have to do all these different things. But during those times, you have to be quiet and you have to pray. And during the prayer, you have to pray for the people that you're creating that gift for. After all this is over, you give this gift to those persons, like a big dish of berries that you pick, or a pair of moccasins that you made, or something that you're going to give back to your community in some way. And you prepare the food and bring it to the tea dance, to the circle, so everybody will have a piece of your banh. And everybody teases you because they will tell you, you have to make your own recipe, and you're going to be, one day you're going to have a baby, and how are you going to be raising your children? And you're going to have lots of patience, and you have to talk. You can't be quiet when you have to talk to your baby. And that's something that's really an important part of growing. And because you have to use all of your senses and your values and be grown up enough to know the difference between those kinds of teachings that are experiences, and to continue to express those so that they are not lost, and that you also have time to grieve those losses and talk about them, even though people don't want to hear it and they want to shut you down because you speak of those painful places. And those are some of the ways that we must heal ourselves so that we can continue to teach. And it's hard because I know that my oldest daughter, she didn't speak any English. And then when I am talking to her in my language, when we move away, I tell her, at home we only talk in our language. Everybody else over there at the school and everything else, they speak it over there anyway. So when you're over there, you speak English, but at home you speak to me in our language. And so that's how it was. And that's how it should be. And that's how we must continue to gather and to not be so divided.
Okay. Thank you for that advice, Molly. So I guess if the opportunity is there, you know, we need to immerse our children, our grandchildren, in the language, because language is really our way of life. You know, it's kind of divided when we enter that school system, right? Because students are expected to learn the English language once they enter the school system. But I think the message that I'm getting from Molly is that, you know, if you still speak your language, you know, speak the language to your children and grandchildren, even if they don't understand. You know, I think eventually when they hear the language often, they will develop a really good understanding of conversations that are happening around them. And eventually, you know, be able to speak maybe one of the languages in conversation with family members. So, you know, I know it's a long process. I do remember, you know, the experience that we had as well growing up with my parents and grandparents and extended family members. The language was always used in conversation in everyday living. What I wanted to do now is maybe turn it over to Elmer Ghostkeeper, because he asked if he could share some words as well. And then Molly, I'll get back to you towards the end part of our session. All right. Miigwech. Okay, Elmer, did you want to share some thoughts, ideas?
I do. For my birthday gift, I received a book, what I haven't been able to put down. It's called Hospicing Modernity, and I'll show you the cover. And I sent a picture of the cover to Corinne to share with whomever. And she might post it on the website, but I highly recommend this book to the staff and to the students. And I'm going to read you just a paragraph. You've heard me say before that I have concern with using Roman orthography, English alphabet, writing out the sounds of indigenous languages. And I haven't been able to come across any writing until I started reading this Hospicing Modernity. Hospicing means that you assist someone or something or some being in passing and having a peaceful, slow death. And her thesis is that's what's happening to modernity. It no longer can be sustained. And the underpinning of it, of course, as we all know, is violence, especially violence towards the people that have lived in countries that have been colonized. And we're seeing that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, but there will be a revolution where the bottom becomes the top and the top becomes the bottom. And that's starting to happen. So I'm going to read you the section. It's on page 46, and it's in the chapter she calls the most important chapter. On the one hand, I should say that this approach to storytelling and the stories that come from it emerge from oral practices where voice, pitch, pause, breathing, rhythm, intonation, relationships, setting, and repetition are all integral to the mutual dance that the telling and the story create. I am not convinced that alphabetic writing with its usual focus on fixed and general obsession and description and prescription, can have a similar effect or do justice to this approach. On the other hand, if we are to open different possibilities for seeing, sensing, relating, and imagining, we will need to figure out how to interpret our usual ways of doing things and the satisfaction we have with what has been normalized as natural, true, and desirable. Technologies such as writing will need to be used experimentally in different ways. This is the only place I've been able to find a reference that supports my view that indigenous languages should not be written in the colonizer's language, because we're just further colonizing our indigenous languages. And what Molly shared is dead on, that indigenous languages were oral, and they should remain oral. That's the way we learned to speak in the first place, whether it was indigenous or English. From the time we could hear a sound, our mothers made. And as we know, the meaning sits in the sound, and we can interpret the sound as we get older. These English words I'm speaking are nothing but sounds. And meaning sits in the sound, but Mother Earth has a language as well. And her language is made up of many different complex sounds that are all around us, and most people are just not aware of them, or they ignore them just as an animal or nature. But they're living beings. And I also had, years ago, wanted to know why the Europeans, the colonizers, were so disconnected from land and from nature. And she references the Greeks. One of the Greek philosophers had said that a tree and the land no longer teaches them anything. And that was the beginning of education and the separation from the land. Molly's stories and teachings are about living with the land, learning from the land. Nowadays, people live off the land, and they're so far removed from it. My observation is, especially in urban centers and towns, you hear machine noises, machine sounds that you really can't interpret. And you hear the constant slap of tires on pavement, in this case, frozen pavement. Engineers call that the city hum, and they cannot get rid of it. It's always there in the background. So that's what I wanted to share with you, and I recommend that let everyone read this book. It's very, very timely. She also says that some people might be not mature enough to read it yet, because they're so focused on modernity to give them the good, happy life. But we know that's not true, because today the cost of living, and I read and I heard the price of food has gone up another 10% from last month. It's getting out of reach. It's only the rich that can afford it. And my natural gas bill in winter is usually about $130. Last month, it was $330. Mm-hmm. You know, how can a family of, say, four or five live comfortably? The food banks just can't keep up with the demand. You know, last night I attended a cancer care strategy for men. I sit on the committee here in Buffalo Lake. And our committee started a community pantry where people can come and get food. And other people donate the food, and as well as grocery stores, the settlement buys food, and there's clothing donated as well. You know, we're doing our best to try to, you know, feed people, but this modern lifestyle, it can no longer be sustained, especially for Indigenous people. And students, because we've all been students, they struggle. They really struggle. And I understand the food bank at the U of A is struggling too to provide food to the many, many people that access it. So with that, I thought I would share that. But again, I'd just like to say that it's the first place, it's the first book, it's the first reference I've had that we cannot colonize our language using alphabet, the written word, like the written English. As you know, writing is a technology. You know, and our ancestors, as Molly brilliantly illustrated, were all oral. In many different dialects, depending on the context of where they lived. And I grew up not that far from where Molly grew up. And I remember my father and the last hereditary chief, the late Harry Chunkley, were good friends. And as I recall, Harry spoke about five languages, including Cree, French, English, and I don't know how many other different dialects of Dene Da. But after he had passed, that was the end of her hereditary system, because the Indian Act had been imposed on the Dene Da. That's colonization. You know, and I don't want this project to be promoting colonization. You know, to be furthering modernity. So I thought I'd like to share that with you. Thank you so much.
Okay, Miigwech, for your words, Elmer, and also your wisdom, as well as your reflections and your responses towards what Molly has shared in regards to her own life experiences. And, you know, I often wonder about, you know, the question around writing in our languages, reading and writing in our languages. And I understand, you know, what you're saying. And I'm thinking back now in terms of how our current institutions are teaching languages. Like for example, my daughters are not fluent in their language, in their languages. But I have one daughter that can read and write the Roman orthography as well as the syllabics. So there's that oral component that she hasn't been able to grasp. And as a result of that, She's kind of moved ahead and started learning the Roman orthography writing system, as well as the syllabics, because that's what the schools are teaching, right? Schools and also universities. So yeah, I thoroughly understand, you know, the concern out there in regards to using a colonized alphabet or writing system to share our languages or to teach our languages to our children and grandchildren and so forth. So thank you, Miigwech, for all of those comments today. I'm actually going to open it up to participants now. And don't worry, Molly, I didn't forget about you. I'll get you to give us some closing comments later. And I also want to give Mary Cardinal Collins a chance to share some closing remarks later. So it's about 2:08. So anybody that wants to ask a question or share a comment, it's open. It's open to anybody right now. Well, it looks like we have a nice quiet group this afternoon. I don't see any questions either on the chat box. I don't know if you see any, Corinne. Are there any other questions? Okay, somebody said their mic is not working. Geraldine. Okay, she says, I'm not sure if you're asking me, what would you recommend? Okay.
Geraldine, you could write your question in the chat if you have a question, and I can read it out. And does anyone have a question that they'd like to ask while Geraldine is writing hers?
I have a question.
Okay.
It's Crystal. Hi, everyone. So the question that I have pertains to those that have been affected by residential schools and the 60 Scoop movement who are no longer in their communities. So they're unable to access language speakers. So is there a recommendation, like, should those try to learn like a local Indigenous language that they're closest to?
Or, hello, Crystal. Is that a question that you want Molly to respond to or one of us?
Yeah, anyone. It's just a question being posed.
Molly, did you want to respond to that question? Oh, I think you have to unmute yourself.
When you have somebody who moved off out of community or was taken away or was taken, basically, what worries me is the fact that we have hospitals here in Edmonton, and there are social workers apprehending babies. In real time today, that is a fact. And when we are talking, when you're asking that question, it is it is a harrowing question based on the fact that the children are being taken away no matter what. No matter how we try to look at the reality of what is happening in real time today, your question has a lot to do with the removal and then after the fact, which is not true, because today we have babies being apprehended from the hospitals. And so we, as language speakers, I would suggest that we have to become most activists. we have to be more than activists. We have to be vigilant and to find and create spaces. Like even here at the university, there's no place to go and talk your language. And unless you have a group of Cree speakers who are in the same room. And sometimes you have to make an effort. And like for an elderly grandparent, if I take my little grandchild and hold my grandchild and say, Miwa son, that's like in Cree. And you celebrate that word, Miwa son. Even if it's one word, it's good enough. Even if it's one word, next you add one more word. In my language, you say newate. Halo newate. I care for you so much. And if you say that to the non-Indigenous speaker, they will learn to grab that and hold on to it and hold on to themselves as somebody who got taken without their consent or permission. And it's not a mistake. It's part of our history and it's part of our present day that will become history. And one of the things I learned is you have to be able to laugh and you have to be able to have lots of fun and tease and be sometimes like you have to say to little ones, you have to sing in your language. And in my culture, one of the things I know is the elderly, like men or women back in the, like in when I was growing up, they would take the little baby and say, and they would just make the baby dance. Or we would have a celebration at in the summertime in the first tea dance for that season, where in the summertime is the season when they dance the babies into the circle, where you have the drumming, and then some of the smallest babies would be danced behind the drummers by the grandparents or whoever. And then they would, another family member would come and scoop up that little baby and go into the circle and start dancing with the baby. And during those kinds of practices, you have a lot of teachings that are part of that. And for Crystal, I would suggest that you just go over there and you be part of that movement that will fulfill your story, and that you won't feel that you need to have permission to be part of the language.
Okay, thank you for that response, Molly. We have actually, there was a really big question asked, so I'm going to address it. And if Mary Cardinal Collins is still with us, I know that she's a longtime educator, and I know that she taught Cree as well in her former years. Mary, can you respond to this huge question? The question is, how would one begin a language program in a school and what grade would you start? Maybe if you can just give us a snapshot of how this person can proceed in ensuring that a language program is being offered in their community or in their school.
Right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Same on.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks to everyone. I'm feeling a little kind of out of it today because my laptop's on a blink and I'm doing this by phone and I don't have, I don't even know how to access my chat on this line. Anyway, what we used to do, I worked for Northland School Division, which is like, I think 95% indigenous in population. We used to make sure that, and these were individual communities. During my time, it was maybe 23 or 24 individual small communities. And we would always make sure that we were doing the bidding of the will of the community. So they would always do a community, kind of a community assessment, community survey to make sure that people were, most of the people in the community, the parents of the students were willing to, or wanted the program, wanted the second language program. So usually if the survey was done, most people were supportive. There were some people that were not. And at first this surprised me, but there at the time, some of the reasons were my kids are fluent from home. Why should they take it in school? So we had to kind of address that that viewpoint. And so mostly people were supportive. So usually a program's set out and we offered it being a provincial system. And this is different from the First Nation system is the federal system is we'd offer it as a second, Cree as a second language, which is a model that we use. But this model is not, it doesn't produce proficient or fluent speakers because of the way it's set up. Meaning that your time in with Cree language or learning the Cree language would be as a subject, eh? So maybe three times a week, three half hours a week. So that didn't, that wasn't enough time to develop any kind of fluency. And we learned this, is a lesson that we've learned over 30 years that Cree as a second language has been taught in the schools. So I don't think, if the kids are fluent from home, then maybe you would produce some fluency. But if they were not, if school was their only place of learning, and this happens more in urban centers than the country centers. And so it didn't produce fluent speakers. And so now I think the the model that is in that we wish, and there's I think a lot of support for it, is the immersion model. And maybe that's the only way we can immersion and on the land. And so that I'm not sure that the city, the urban centers would be able to accommodate all of the immersion practices, like being on the land. So that is up in the air right now. I think most people, I don't even know if I could say a lot, but there are some immersion programs, some that are pretty long standing, like the Onion Lake program. And so we need to ask Onion Lake how their immersion program's going for fluency with their students of maybe 20 years back. So see how that is going over there. Okay. I feel a little disabled because I don't, well, you can't see me, which is a good thing because I didn't do my hair today. So it's a good thing.
Okay, Mary, I thank you for your response, and my apology to cut you off. It was a very big question, but I just want to mention to Geraldine, I think that Elder Mary Cardinal Collins did provide, some suggestions. Like in some of the city schools, they do offer an ancestral language or indigenous languages as a subject, which means they're offered 30 to 40 minutes throughout the week, starting at the early grades. And I think your second question was, when should we start them? I think students should probably start learning their language, right from the start.
Yes.
Right from nursery, kindergarten. I think that's important, rather than trying to start from the higher grades. Because one of the experiences we had when we taught high school is that the students there were just so self-conscious, and they did not want to speak the language in class or with other peers, because they thought, oh, that person's going to laugh at me, or, they were so too shy to even try and learn their languages at that age already. So the sooner the better, start them off as soon as you can. So if you have a nursery kindergarten program, start the language program at that level. And your question is so big that we can probably talk about this for the next few days. So I'm gonna stop there, only because it's 2:25 now. But I want to give Molly maybe a chance to maybe share any other highlights that you've shared with us this afternoon, and we'll close off with a prayer. And I'm gonna ask Elder Mary Cardinal to share a prayer with us, because one of the things that I learned from Mary was that she said, if you start a meeting or a session or a gathering with a prayer, she said, always make sure that you close off with a prayer. So that has always stuck with me since I've met her. So I'm going to follow through with that shortly. So Molly, do you have any other final highlights that you can share with us before we close off for today? Oh, you have to unmute.
One important message that I want to leave today with everybody is, because we are community-based, our language, like one of the things that I learned was, when the government and the church and everybody else outlawed our languages and forbade us to stop talking amongst ourselves, and And also, there was a lot of, there were laws that were passed to eradicate our culture practices. And because of those kinds of things, we didn't do ceremonies and dances and those kinds of practices that really helped us to sacred places in our lives. And today I want to acknowledge that our Denda school principal, Carlito Somera, hello, is here. And Sally Wasp Collin. Yes, and if you do the next Kasi sa niti ho joa diyo. Selon dats in dakte. I'm so happy to see your names here. And I know that I am going to go to the school with somebody from the university to go and answer some of the big questions in the class with the kids, because it's always nice to see the children back home. And I know lots of our children in certain areas are, they speak Dene first. And I remember 30 years ago talking to an elder in one of my home communities, and he said to me,
"What are you doing?"
In my language, I call hat odi zi guadehi deu zi dag ne set lai e jiho gedehiu in lehio ginde. Hei a go a sa konezi. He said, when we went to Chate for a meeting, I saw and heard all these little children, very small children running around, and they were talking in only in Dene. Oh, did that ever make my heart laugh? And I want to leave you with that. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate your time, and that no matter how desperate sometimes we think we are struggling to protect and to preserve our way of knowing, we have to understand that in speaking and in talking with the little ones, we are going to instill those values. And even if you sing to the little ones in your language, and that they will remember, because all this that I shared with you is from the remembering, from the kinship, the family that I grew up with, that I had to really unravel those stories, those values, in order to find the meaning to be able to bring all of this back to my community. My school principal is sitting here, and my relative Sally Wasp Collin is sitting here. And this to me speaks volumes about the work of the community-based language speaking and our goals, our visions, that we are not alone, that we as a group are doing something different. And that even if we don't see it, like Elmer was saying, we can sense it. because we learn from that touch, taste, smell. Like even if we smell moose, dry meat, smoking outside, if we smell sage, if we, then we go out on the land and we smell the smoke of the fire outside, even that says something to us. And I will continue saying that in gathering, we are, oh my gosh, we are not no longer divided. And if we go to gatherings, we are more involved in, like everybody feels welcome. And my grandpa used to say, when you come to the tea dance, it's a big, big, big circle. The circle holds everybody in here. There is not one person that did not come to this circle without bringing something. There is not one person that came here that will go home without nothing. So, ka hore tamasi.
Thank you for Masicho for sharing all of those teachings, Molly, from a Dene perspective. I know the message that I'm taking away from this session today is that it's really important, you know, to know who you are as an Indigenous person or as an Anishinaabe person, and also to know your community, like where are you from? Because my grandfather used to always say to us too, "Ke guika wanike ken ande wenjian shigo awenen kin," and basically what that translates to is what he told us was that don't forget who you are and where you come from. So that's the same message that I'm getting from all of the teachings and the stories that you've shared with us this afternoon, Molly. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart, and also on behalf of all of the participants here this afternoon. So with that, I'd like to turn it back to Mary Cardinal Collins. And I don't know if I mentioned earlier, Mary Cardinal Collins is one of the advisory members for SILR, the Supporting Indigenous Languages Revitalization. And I'm going to ask her if she can maybe close off with a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Mary?
Yes. Yes, hi. First of all, thank you, Molly, for your presentation. Masicho. And also when I was kind of scanning the people at the meeting, and I thought I saw Gina Cole's name. And if she's here, I just wanted to shout to an old, former colleague from Alberta Ed years ago. So with that, I'll just say that I'll say the closing prayer for today's meeting. And again, thank you to Molly, and all good wishes and the best to all the other languages aside from Cree, Nehiyowin. And sometimes we forget that there's a number of other languages. When I was working for Alberta Ed back in the day, we counted 11 languages in Alberta, 11 languages other than English. And these are Indigenous languages, of course. And some of them, like we'd say, well, that is a dialect. So we counted under one, and they'd say, no, they wanted us to make sure that each area even if it was quite different from the other areas' language, quite different or quite the same, I should say. They wanted to be looked at as perceived as unique. So with that, I'll just say a prayer.
I want to mention that, yeah, we didn't, we couldn't hear the prayer, but that's fine. Okay. I think when that happens, we can say our own prayers, right?
Yes.
Okay. Miigwech, Masicho, Marcy. What else? Hi. I forgot that. And Egwese, Egwesani. Thank you to all of you. I just have a couple of little announcements here. You'll note that the whole session has been recorded, so we will be reviewing the recording based on our guests sharing this afternoon, and it will be shared via our website, the Siller website, and also through YouTube eventually within the next couple of weeks. And Corinne will also be sending out a survey, you know, because we don't have any more time. I think we've exceeded our time allocation. But I want to say thank you to Darcy Wolf. He also shared some thoughts and ideas in regards to in regards to learning his language, and that he had started learning Cree at a later age, and also that they are starting an immersion school in Edmonton. And I guess the person to be talking to would be Wayne Jackson. And I believe we have him coming for our March 31st Indigenous Languages Symposium. So just bits and pieces of information there. But you can still send your comments or your questions through the survey. It will be sent out probably by tomorrow. So Miigwech, thank you, and have a good afternoon and evening. We'll just stay on for a couple more minutes, but for the rest of you, thank you for joining us.